that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that, that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Order now at Acura.com.
A quick heads up before we get started. This episode is about child sexual assault.
This story is about a teenage girl in Louisiana. We're going to protect her identity by calling her by her middle name, which is Nicole. I wanted to spend time with Nicole because of something that happened to her back in 2020 when she was 14 years old.
Jessica Contrera is a reporter at The Post, and over the past year, she has spent a lot of time with Nicole, who was 17 when they met.
Nicole reported being sexually assaulted by a friend of hers. And on the day that she made that report, she met a New Orleans police officer. A few months later, that same police officer sexually assaulted Nicole. That really struck me. This person who'd responded to her report of sexual assault, who was supposed to be there to protect her, ended up assaulting her too.
In an exclusive investigation, Jessica and a team of journalists at The Post found that over the past two decades, hundreds of police officers have preyed on children. And the children who are most likely to be targeted by officers are teenage girls, just like Nicole.
As a society, we have been forced to reckon with the risks that are present when you have adults with a lot of authority over and access to kids. We've talked about priests and teachers and coaches, but that conversation really hasn't been had around police officers.
Jessica's reporting also revealed how police departments nationwide have failed to protect children from these crimes. But Nicole decided to stand up against the police officer who assaulted her and the department he worked for.
So 1,000%, I believe that they are responsible for it and need to be held accountable.
From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers, and it's Wednesday, March 27th. Today, we hear how crimes like this, law enforcement officers sexually abusing children, aren't as rare as you might think. And we hear what it's taken for Nicole to hold one police department and the city of New Orleans accountable. Okay, so Jessica, I want to learn more about Nicole. Tell me a little bit about her background, what she's like, and about her growing up.
Nicole, in so many ways, she's just a typical teenager. She's trying to figure out who she wants to be in life. She spends a lot of time on TikTok and Snapchat. When I was at her mom's house in New Orleans, I noticed her bedroom looked like I think mine and a lot of other people's did growing up, where she had that mix of things that feel really grown up, like this makeup station that looked, you know, so professional, right next to something that feels so childlike, like this big stuffed giraffe that's in the corner.
What is the giraffe?
My mom got this from a hospital gift shop for me. I forget what reason I was in the hospital for, but it was, like, some medical issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then that one my grandma got me.
Does the giraffe have a name?
No. Because I'm indecisive. Okay. I would change it, like, every week. Once it was Raffy.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2020, when Nicole was 14, she was dealing with some pretty tumultuous stuff. Her parents, they were divorced, and so she moved back and forth between them. She and her mom spent some time in a domestic violence shelter. Nicole had also struggled with self-harm. And so when she looks back on that time period now, she understands she was already in a pretty vulnerable place.
And tell me, what was going on in Nicole's life when this story starts?
So Nicole and her mom, they were living in this apartment in New Orleans that was really a safe haven for them. Nicole had her own bedroom. And there was this day when a friend of hers decided to come over, and he said he needed a place to stay. He was a few years older than her. He was 17. And he ended up staying the night at her house. And Nicole told police later that that night he sexually assaulted her. Now, this was a child sex crimes case. And so there was a detective assigned to it by the New Orleans Police Department. But that detective on that first day, she barely spent any time with Nicole. Instead, Nicole was left in the hands of a different officer, just a regular patrol officer, this 53-year-old officer named Rodney Vignair. So we obtained a copy of the body camera footage through public records requests and with Nicole's permission.
Hey, y'all can come in. I'm actually on the phone with a detective right now.
Okay, I'm Officer Vignair. How you doing?
Doing all right. I'm on the family justice. You got.
And we hear Vignair strike this really casual tone with Nicole and her mom.
All right, I'm Officer Vignair. This is Officer Carroll. This is Officer Carcum. I'm not going to ask you a bunch of questions. I'm not even going to ask you more than two questions, all right, because that's between you, your mom, and the detectives.
And then he said something that really mattered to Nicole.
But I understand you don't want to go to the hospital.
He said, I understand that you don't want to go to the hospital. He sort of talks to her just like he's talking to, you know, the adults in the room. He treats her with a certain level of respect that I think that any 14-year-old, especially one who's just been through a difficult situation, is looking for. And so she sort of immediately warms up to him. And he presents himself as a friend to her, a friend who has advice for her about why she should listen to him and go to the hospital.
You really should think about it, because if I'm a young man that has done something wrong to a young lady and she doesn't follow up and press the issue, then I'm going to go out and do it to another young lady. And it's going to be worse maybe the next time, because I'm going to think in my head, oh, I got the power. I can go further this time.
Right.
So not only.
So by sort of telling her that she might be enabling a predator, he convinces her to go to the hospital. And then he sort of approaches it as like, we're all having a good time here. He takes her out to the car.
Keys and
Locked up. All right, this first police car right here.
Can I ride shotgun?
No, you can't ride shotgun.
Please?
No. You can ride shotgun on the back seat.
She's like, can I take a picture of this?
Can I, like, take a picture of this or no? Is that, like, illegal?
Yeah. Okay, there we go. You want to get in with me?
And they end up taking a selfie together in which he wraps his arm around her like they're bestest of friends.
We can do a better one later if you want.
So as they're driving, Nicole's mom, Rain, she starts to open up about everything Nicole has been through. And that's when Officer Vignair, he sort of positions himself as somebody who can mentor Nicole, somebody that she could confide in.
Yeah. I'll give you, your mom will have my number, I'll give it to you, and I'll give you my Yahoo email. You can, if you ever just want to shoot, talk, text me, whatever, you having problems, just need somebody to talk to. If I'm working, I'll come swing by and talk to you.
Oh, my God.
Okay?
That's awesome.
Yes, ma'am, can you put us out on a 22A, grab your and
when all the, restaurants open back up and we can sit inside and talk and I'm working? As long as your mom don't mind, we'll go get some ice cream at McDonald's or something. Okay?
They get to the hospital, and they go to the check-in desk, and Officer Vignair, he's standing right next to them. His body camera is still on the whole time. And as they wait in the hospital waiting room, Officer Vignair is talking with Nicole, and the conversation, it's very sexual in nature from the start. He talks with Nicole about what kind of pictures she takes of herself and whether those pictures are too revealing. Eventually, Nicole goes back to an exam room. And still, Officer Vicknair is there. And he's not waiting outside in the hall, you know, keeping a respectful distance. He goes into the exam room with her. And he's sitting there talking with her about drinking and partying and giving her all of this advice.
Don't trust people you just meet. Don't trust people that you don't know. Always have your guard up.
And what did Nicole tell you about how she was feeling in that moment hearing that?
Nicole knew that it was a little weird, right? But at the same time, he's a police officer. He's there to help. And she's just trying to get through something that is really, really difficult. So she tried not to worry about it. She tried to understand that, oh, here's this guy who's offering to be her friend.
So then what happens after the hospital visit, after Nicole is examined, and after they leave?
Before Vicknair leaves the hospital, he gives Nicole his phone number. He puts Nicole's number in his phone. And by the end of that night, they're texting each other.
Texting about what?
At first, he's saying, you know, let me know when you get home, you know, checking on her. Then what starts with text turns to coming over and seeing her in person. So at first, these sort of drop-bys are really friendly. He would kind of keep lecturing her about staying out of trouble, and her mom might chat with him and things like that. Then she noticed his demeanor towards her kind of started to change. She talks about him asking her once when her mom wasn't there, do you have any booty shorts?
I don't know. I was just saying I was stupid because what was running through my mind at the time is, oh, he's just a guy. You know, that's how guys think. I didn't really think it was bad. I was just like, oh, he's a dude.
She starts to also talk to him on the phone late at night, like late at night. He admitted later that they would talk on the phone at like 11, sometimes 1 in the morning, which if you think about the fact that he's a 53-year-old and she's a 14-year-old, I think that would raise some suspicions. But again, her mom is hearing her say,
oh, I had the best talk with Rodney last night. Mom, he's so nice. I remember one morning in particular, she said to me, I opened up, I told him everything. Mom, he was so nice.
At a time when, you know, after she's just been through a report of sexual assault, she's shutting her mom out like crazy. But she's opening up to this officer, and so the mom thinks, okay, maybe this is a good thing. What starts as things that made Nicole uncomfortable cross a line into things that are highly inappropriate and criminal. Nicole talks about how on these phone calls, Vicknair asked her to send him nude photos. She talks about the really descriptive sexual things that he would say to her. Then there are instances in which she describes him touching her.
We were sitting on the couch and, like, he did that stupid move that guys do where they, like, yawn. And they put their arm around you. And, like, I've seen that in, like, rom-coms. And still I'm like, really, dude? And then he, like, moved his arm. And, like, I was, like, sitting, like, right here on this side. And then, like, his hand, like, went on, like, my thigh.
The thing that escalated and was most egregious, the federal prosecutors ended up saying, was what happened one night when he got off work and came back to her house. On a Wednesday in September of 2020, this is about 4 months after Nicole first met Vicknair, he was on duty that day and he came by Nicole's house in the afternoon. And then at 11 o'clock that night, after he got off work, he went back to Nicole's house. Nicole went outside and she says that Vicknair told her to get into his truck. Prosecutors would say later that he locked the doors And that is when he penetrated her with his fingers.
How did this all start to come out? How did someone become aware that this was happening?
By the time Nicole was assaulted in Vignere's truck that night, the New Orleans Police Department had already been alerted that there was problems with Vignere's behavior. A couple of days earlier, Nicole's mom had found a picture of Nicole and Vignere that they had taken together. In it, you can see Nicole is pressed up against Vignere's body. He's sort of hugging her from behind. As soon as Nicole's mom sees this, she starts to worry.
That I just was uncomfortable with the proximity of where their body touching, you know, him being behind her and engaging in that way, and that kind of physical closeness.
Nicole talks about it like, at this point, she's pretty scared to say what's going on.
He's like, you realize I'm a cop, right? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, you realize I can put anyone in handcuffs that I want. So I like that was kind of like I think him threatening me if anyone like found out. Mm-hmm. So I was also scared too. That's why I just kind of like went along with.
So at this point, Nicole, she's scared to admit everything that's going on. But the adults in her life, her mom and her therapist, they know that this is not okay. And so they take what ends up being a really important step. They contact this office in New Orleans. It's called the Independent Police Monitor. It's the citizen oversight agency that helps citizens deal with the police. And then the Independent Police Monitor, when they hear about what's going on with Vignere, they take a second really important step. The Independent Police Monitor, on that Friday night, texted the head of the New Orleans Police Department. And the text message said that there were concerns about potential sexual abuse of a minor by a police officer.
And what did Nicole's mom say to you about how she felt when she started to get a sense of what had happened between her daughter and Officer Vignere?
I think she was afraid to believe what she was seeing. You know, she'd put her trust in this person. This person was a police officer. She had encouraged him to come over on Nicole's birthday or for Nicole to confide in him.
He had forced his way into our little life. It started slow, believe me. He asked me in the hospital if he could, like, no lie, take her for ice cream. Like, that's the way he tried to portray himself. He said, if you're okay with it, I'd like the opportunity to be a mentor and just be a good friend. And I think she needs that. And she needs a positive male role model.
And how do you feel hearing that?
I mean, I wasn't mad at him, you know, because he was right, you know. And I didn't really think about it a lot one way or the other. I just was like, oh, wow, this is nice. Someone's trying to help us. And so it was welcomed, you know, because I was naive and stupid and trusted him, you know.
And now she's seeing something that shows that this officer's behavior toward her daughter is completely different than what she had imagined.
And because of that, you know, sense of power and authority that he had that made her trust him, I can also imagine that's what made it really difficult or scary to report what she had seen. Talk to me about how she felt in that moment, making that decision of, I need to tell someone that this is happening.
Yeah, there's a moment in the notes from a call between the therapist and the Independent Police Monitor that says the family is scared of retaliation. Her mom knew that to accuse a New Orleans police officer was no small thing.
We'll take a quick break there. Next up, what happens after Nicole and her mother report Officer Vignere? We'll be right back.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
So before we hear what happened after Nicole's mom reported Officer McNair, I want to understand a little bit more about him, who he was, and how he became a cop.
So McNair is a little bit unusual on his path to policing. He didn't actually become a police officer until he was about to turn 40 years old. He had previously worked as a EMT and a hospital security guard. And then in 2006, so after Hurricane Katrina had struck New Orleans, he decided to apply to the New Orleans Police Department. This was a really difficult time for the police department. There was a ton of scrutiny around the way that officers had responded during the hurricane and after. And so the police department was facing major staffing shortages. And what we know now is that they actually were lowering the standards for their background checks. So this became pretty clear when I looked at McNair's application to the police department. There were some obvious red flags. So the first thing I noticed was that McNair had been arrested multiple times before. One of the times that he was arrested happened just the year before he applied. He was arrested for something really serious, a domestic violence incident in which police said that he brandished a knife at his ex-girlfriend, hit her boyfriend in the face, and made threats to her in the presence of sheriff's deputies. But when the background check investigator for the New Orleans Police Department looked at this, he wrote that this arrest shouldn't reflect poorly on McNair's application because those charges were eventually dropped. Then there was something else that really stuck out to me. When we looked at McNair's background, we learned that he was arrested and convicted for another serious crime back in 1987. It was a simple battery on a juvenile. Now, I talked to McNair's family members about this, and what they said was that this charge happened after McNair was in a sexual relationship with a minor. This girl, she was a preteen at the time, and McNair was 20. But when we looked at the background check conducted on McNair by the New Orleans Police Department, there was no mention of this conviction.
So then once McNair became a police officer for the New Orleans Police Department, what was his career like?
McNair worked as a patrol officer in the 1st District. That's where Nicole would one day live. And during that time, there were a lot of complaints about him. We counted about 12 complaints in total. Now, a lot of these things, you know, he was accused of excessive force, he was accused of stealing, he was accused of reckless driving. NOPD didn't always punish him for these things. Sometimes they would say, you know, that the complaint was unfounded. But there were two incidents that he was punished for that really stuck out to me. And in both of them, he was accused of mocking or harassing women that he interacted with while he was on the job. But despite all of that, in 2016, McNair was promoted, and he became somebody whose job it was to mentor new police officers as they were completing their training.
What has the New Orleans Police Department said about McNair's history as an officer?
The New Orleans Police Department has declined many times to talk with us about McNair because eventually Nicole and her mom filed a civil lawsuit against the city. But one thing the police department did say was that in the years since Vicknair was hired, they have improved their background check process and a lot of their other practices and policies.
Let's go back to Nicole. Where we left off, the NOPD had just been contacted about potential sexual abuse of a minor by an officer. What did they do once they got this information?
They got that information, that alarming text message to the head of the New Orleans Police Department, on a Friday. And as far as we know, the internal investigator who was assigned to the case, Lawrence Jones, he didn't actually begin investigating Vicknair until Monday, according to his notes. So on that Monday, when he started talking to Nicole and her mom, Nicole didn't tell him everything that was going on with Vicknair, but he did see some pretty important things. Nicole showed him her text messages in which Vicknair was calling her all of these pet names like Baby and Boo. Jones also saw the picture of Vicknair and Nicole, the one that had alerted Nicole's mom that something was wrong, in which Nicole is pressed up against Vicknair's body. But despite those things, Vicknair was not suspended that day. He was left on duty. And 2 days later, that's when he went back to Nicole's house. That's the night he assaulted her inside his truck.
And so why didn't the police department suspend Vicknair, at least temporarily as a safeguard, as soon as they started investigating him for such a serious crime?
That is a really good question, and one we have asked the New Orleans Police Department repeatedly. We've also asked to interview the investigator, Lawrence Jones, but the police department has repeatedly declined to answer any questions about what happened during that week or how their investigation unfolded. What we do know is that it took a week for Vicknair to be arrested, a whole week that passed after the head of the New Orleans Police Department was texted about concerns of sexual abuse of a juvenile by an officer. When Vicknair eventually did get arrested, that same internal investigator, Lawrence Jones, he brings Vicknair in the middle of the night to interview him.
So today's date is September 26, 2020. Time now is 1:56 a.m. This statement has been taken under NOPD item number IS and IRA 32727.
So we were able to obtain a video of this interview, and you can hear how he does deny that he ever penetrated Nicole, but he can't exactly deny everything because they have a lot of evidence against him. And so he starts to sort of come up with explanations. So he says that even though he had sexual photos of Nicole on his phone, he had only screenshotted them because he was worried about what she was posting and worried about what could happen to her.
I screenshotted all the ones to in case something ever did happen that she's posted.
So you have, how many years have you been on the police department? 14, 15 years you've been a police officer. Mm-hmm. And you screenshot new photos of—
Not new.
So you don't have no new photos in your
phone? No new photos, no.
So whatever photos you screenshot of her were inappropriate, because that's what you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if they were inappropriate, as a 14, 15-year veteran, you want me to believe that at no point did you decide, you instead of stopping it, you screenshotted and kept them?
So what happens after that interview?
Vicknair gets charged with sexual battery, indecent behavior with a juvenile, and malfeasance in office. He spends about 7 days in jail and then is released on bond. And this is the beginning of a really long waiting period in Nicole's life. It takes years for this case to work its way through the criminal justice system. And during that time, Nicole really started to understand the lasting impacts of what happened to her.
And what did she say about that?
I think we can all understand that experiencing a sexual assault is a really traumatic thing that might end up with a lot of post-traumatic stress symptoms or triggers, things like that. And of course, that happens for her. But there's this added element. The abuser in this case is a police officer, somebody she was supposed to trust. And so everything about what comes next in her life is influenced by this question of, can she really trust anyone? You know, she freezes up when she sees a police car, even when she's just driving. She drives like crazy carefully to make sure that she never gets pulled over. She has these nightmares about him.
And then at one point, I remember I took two kitchen knives and I put them in that hiding space in the closet. So that way, like, if he were to open the closet door, I'd be able to get him at, like, his ankle level.
Even during this time, especially because he was out and wasn't in prison yet, she was scared that he was going to come and retaliate against her in some way.
I can't imagine how hard a time this was for Nicole at this point. I'm curious, in the criminal case against McNair, like, how is that going and how is that proceeding?
During those years of waiting, this case was actually taken over by the Department of Justice. And they charged McNair with a pretty important crime. It was violating Nicole's civil rights under the color of law. That's kind of a jargony term, but you probably have heard of it before when we talk about how officers use excessive force on duty. McNair eventually decided that he would plead guilty to this crime. So in March of 2023, he went to his sentencing hearing. That was the first time Nicole and him were in the same place together since that night in his truck.
What was that like for her?
That day was incredibly intense. Nicole had tried to do her best to prepare. She wrote a victim impact statement. She went and got a new outfit. You know, when she walked into the courtroom, you could see she was just sort of like steeling herself, like ready to face this. But then McNair walked in and he was hobbled over. He was walking with a cane. He was coughing. It was clear that he was really, really sick. So she just tried not to look at him. And she went up to the microphone and she read this incredibly powerful poem that she brought as her victim impact statement. I couldn't record it because we can't record in federal courtrooms, but I want to read a little bit of what she wrote. There's a girl in a room. She turns out the light. A shadow appears to torment what's in sight. To her, he appears as a helping hand, but little does she know he had other plans. He tears her down and makes her suffer, yet she comes out 10 times tougher. Now every night, the light stays on, scared he will return. She hopes he has had a change in heart and that he has learned.
So what ends up happening with the charges that were brought against McNair?
He was ultimately sentenced to 14 years in prison. That was pretty significant because prosecutors had initially asked for 7 years, and the judge had come back and said this really wasn't enough time. But he didn't go to prison right away. Because of his health issues, the judge indicated that he was going to be able to have some time to get some medical care before he turned himself in. And so 2 months later, Nicole is like still waiting for him to go to prison. She's still really freaked out about him being out. And she's spending a lot of days like sleeping all day. But on this one day, you know, she decides to go out and run some errands. She's looking at her phone, and that's when she sees this Snapchat notification. Her screen was showing her this, you know, like the Bitmoji of like a waving guy. And it said, "Officer Rodney added you as a friend."
And I like literally, I started shaking. I threw my phone down on my lap and I'm like, this is not real. And I'm like, at first I literally thought that I was like seeing. But yeah, it was super weird. I didn't like that at all.
She would come to realize that he was actually trying to Snapchat her from the hospital bed. He had found out that he actually had a really serious brain tumor, and he was in the hospital to have brain surgery before he reported to prison. Any sense of ease and safety that she had obtained after he was sentenced and she knew, like, he's going to go to prison, was immediately wiped away in that moment because she didn't understand how it was possible for him to be contacting her.
And when you talked to Nicole and her mom about just the lasting effect that all of this had left on their lives, what did they say?
They are still living this every day. For her, whether it's, you know, that she doesn't want to go to the emergency room when she's sick because she doesn't want to relive what happened to her at the emergency room. The relationship she has with her mom is really, really strained because they both have been processing this in their own ways and process trauma differently and fight a lot about what happened.
So I want to zoom out for a second here and just, I'm curious to hear how this story, what Nicole went through and her interactions with the New Orleans Police Department, how that, what that embodies when it comes to this bigger issue of police committing sexual crimes in ways that I think we have not wrapped our heads around. What do you see here as like the big takeaways of the story and of the reporting?
This case shows just how crimes like this happen all over America. Questionable background checks, whether or not the investigation is taken seriously from the start, what these departments do after they learn they have a potential sexual abuser in their midst, what systems are in place to flag red flags when officers are having inappropriate conduct with kids? Do we let officers be alone with kids for extended periods of time? And if so, what are the systems in place to make sure that those interactions are appropriate? When these allegations are raised, are we dismissing the kids and saying, oh, that couldn't have happened? Or are we taking them seriously from the start? What we will get into with our additional reporting this year is then when all these officers are caught, how are they being held accountable?
And with all those questions in mind of how the system works now, I'm curious, like in conversations with experts on policing, if they've talked about potential solutions or ways to prevent these kinds of crimes from happening or discovering more quickly when they are happening.
I think the first thing is even understanding that they are happening. We have talked to police officers, prosecutors, advocates all across the country, and even just recognizing that these aren't one-off crimes, that they're happening in departments big and small, they're happening with fresh new officers, they're happening with chiefs of police, that just recognizing that this can happen is the first step.
So it has been a year since Vic Nair was sentenced to prison. What's going on with him and Nicole?
On January 1st of this year, Vic Nair died in prison. That meant that he served less than 6 months of his prison sentence. After Nicole found out, we got on the phone to talk about how she was feeling.
Honestly, though, I feel like his death was like a little too soon. I wish he rotted in prison for a little more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wish he was miserable for a little longer.
What makes you feel that way?
Because I feel like it's like I kind of wanted him to hurt because he made me hurt.
Even though Vic Nair is no longer alive, Nicole is still pursuing her federal civil rights lawsuit against the city of New Orleans. But a few days before the trial was set to begin, we published our story about Vic Nair and the New Orleans Police Department. Among our findings was that the head of the New Orleans Police Department was texted about potential sexual abuse of a minor days before Vic Nair assaulted Nicole. And in a civil rights case like this that is looking at whether New Orleans is accountable for what happened to Nicole, a text like that really matters. So a few hours after our story was published, the entire trial was postponed. And it's unclear what's going to happen next.
The fact that he died in prison, was there a part of her that was like, you know, it's over? Like, maybe I should just let this go?
Even though there's a large part of her that wants to just put this in her past, and even though Vic Nair is dead now, she has made the decision to continue with her case against the New Orleans Police Department and to try to hold them liable for what happened to her. I think for her, it's this moment of, you know, all these adults have either said what happened to her isn't their fault, or adults were the ones saying this is what he deserves. This is her moment to decide whether or not to take a stand against the police department. And as hard as it is, the idea of testifying before a jury about this, she has decided that she wants to go forward.
Thank God. And you know what? I was looking at myself in the mirror on my 18th birthday, and I start crying. I'm like, you have made it this far through all this you have been through. Because I honestly didn't think that I was going to make it. And I'm just so happy that I don't have to rely on adults anymore. And that I can just, you know, because that was a big issue. And now I'm getting past that issue now.
Jess, thank you so much for sharing the story.
Thank you, Martine.
Jessica Contrera is an enterprise reporter at The Post. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Ariel Plotnick. It was edited by Monica Campbell and mixed by Sam Baer. Thank you also to Linda Robinson, Jen Abelson, Carolyn Van Houten, John D. Harden, Courtney Kahn, Rennie Svernovsky, David Fallis, Anu Narayan Swami, Hayden Godfrey, Riley Cedar, Nate Jones, Roseanne Niklawi, and Alice Kreitz. This kind of investigative reporting would not be possible without the support of subscribers to The Washington Post. If you're not yet a subscriber, now is a great time to do that. Just check out our show notes for the link or head to washingtonpost.com/subscribe. And thank you so much. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.